to do that. One is going to be a trip I just took to Southeast Asia. The other are our exhibits with the Soviet and really a 3-year pretty liberty with the Soviet as a package.
Yeah.
And then the third is just one or two lives. On the visit to Southeast Asia, what I did was this. Went over and attended the meeting of your ambassadors to the Pacific area countries, which took place in Baguio. You met all of the ambassadors to all of the countries in the Pacific Basin.
Hey, Frank.
How about meeting the Philippines? After that, I went to the island or peninsula countries, the green continent. Went to Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, the Philippines. So it's T for me.
Okay.
Now, the purpose was to try to assess attitudes on four questions. The four questions were, after Vietnamization, what? Quo vadis communist China? How do you envision the emerging world of Japan? And where do these three things, after the Vietnamization, like communist China and Japan, how do they link together with the Nixon Doctrine in your field? I talked to two chiefs of state. I talked to Marcos and to Suharto. I talked in most every instance to foreign ministers. From my own view, even more importantly, I talked to editors, writers, heads of television networks, educators, professors, and that sort of situation. Now, I'll start out very briefly with the Chiefs Commission meeting and go through that and then take you on. In the Chiefs Commission meeting, it was rather refreshing because there was a very clear clash of opinion, and I found that refreshing, on two questions, on Japan and China. Your ambassadors are in the Pacific, have clearly opposite views, many of them, on where Japan is going in the Pacific. And they have clearly opposite views on how we should deal with communist China. And those were, those really came out. You probably didn't accept the reports on that. Later on in this, I will mention two men that I think you should keep your eye on for different reasons. One is Bill Porter, who's your ambassador to Korea, and the other is David Osborne, who's your consul general in Hong Kong. I'll come back to the reasons why. Another thing of significance was that I attended the Chiefs Commission Conference a year ago in Tokyo. And at that time, the entire focus of attention was on China, and they were paying very little attention to Japan. This time, they paid a very great deal of attention to where Japan was going, because the factors of Japan's emergence are becoming so self-evident, their economic strength, their potential interests, all of that sort of thing. That was a big difference from a year ago when it was entirely chic to talk about China. And even though the U.S. press focus was on China this time, the ambassadors were very, very interested in where does Japan come into this? There was a very good presentation on dope addiction, and that sat the ambassadors up in their chairs. I come away with the thought, I mentioned this to others, but I think if it were to be implemented, you would have to feel that it was a good idea. You know, if you consider the world as communication centers, and really, the Western world is having four major communication centers, those being Paris, London, New York, and Tokyo. Now, that's where opinion in the West is formed, in those four centers. The reason for that is that France has all the link to the Francophone countries, its agency France-Presse, there's a tremendous influence of Le Monde and the hegemony of France in many places. In England, it's the BBC External Services, it's Reuters worldwide, it's the English language, it's the influence of the London Times, it's the Commonwealth link, it's all of that. And Japan is beginning to dominate communications in Asia, New York for obvious reasons. Therefore, in the world, there are four centers of communication that really set tone. Tokyo, New York, no, this is fine, Paris, and London. Now, in that context, I think you should consider your ambassador to Paris and London, not just a country ambassador, but an ambassador to a communication center. Same thing in Japan. And here you had your ambassadors together for 3 days talking about problems which are intermixed with the whole American image, Vietnam, your proposals on communist China, the question of Taiwan, the question of the UN, dope addiction in Southeast Asia, all of that sort of thing. Annenberg and Watson are politically appointed ambassadors. What they know about those questions is what they've been reading for 10 years in the New York Times. And I couldn't help but think to myself, what an education for those men, Annenberg and Watson, if they were to sit in meetings like this. Because then when they go back to Paris and London, and they have dinner with the head of BBC, or the head of the editorial board of the London Times, or that sort of thing, they have that marvelous anecdotal experience and feel, and the authority that comes from saying, last month when I talked with our ambassadors, or last month when I was in so-and-so, or that sort of thing. Now, I think there is in state, and I don't say this critically, I say it, I think there is an unawareness of what the communications revolution has done in this regard. And they hold a meeting of Pacific ambassadors as if the world stopped at the end of the Pacific, because that's the way it's geographically structured. Now,
that's good.
Yeah. So, I think that if you took your three communications ambassadors, that is Japan, Paris, and London, I think if you thought of them, not just as country ambassadors, but as communications ambassadors to the Western world, it would be useful. So, in consensus on what they think on Southeast Asia about these matters, obviously it varies from country to country, but I think it's fair to say that there is a general consensus along the following line. Their opinions on, after the atomization and our troops are withdrawn, are this, that Hanoi will not use frontline troops in any efforts against South Vietnam, that they will step up protracted war, that they will use the terror and guerrilla conflicts and force sacrifices of village leaders and that sort of thing. The obvious objective being to make South Vietnam in chaos, ungovernable. The people were weary from a coalition government, the communists will eventually take it over. But they will do that by keeping Laos and Cambodia as their channels. Well, there's so much for North Vietnam, South Vietnam. Now, China, which is an entirely separate thing. The Communist China, their consensus judgment is very strong and almost unanimous. And that is, the Communist China will make major subversion efforts, nothing overt, but major subversion efforts, with the first target being Thailand, in northeast Thailand and northern Thailand, and with the second target being Malaysia in Indonesia. Leaving Singapore sort of alone and surrounded through Malaysia and Indonesia, and leaving the Philippines kind of as a sideshow because it's a little out of the picture. Rather a startling thing for me, in these countries, there is an extraordinary lack of perception of the reality of Japan. When you talk about Southeast Asia, there is what the United States is going to do, what communist China is going to do, and what the Soviet Union is going to do. But when you bring into the conversation the fact that Japan is the third industrial nation on Earth, there is no role to material source is essential to it. There is no source of energy. So all of its energy comes from the Persian Gulf and around through the Malacca Straits. When you point out that Japan, under her present budget in 1974, will be spending at the rate of the seventh military power on Earth, which means she'll automatically become that. When you point out the sophistication of her economy, that she can, the extraordinary power, they listen. But it simply hasn't dawned on them as to the enormous role of Japan. And when you say, well, where will Japan mix into this? You're almost forcefully drawing their attention to it. But they right away go back to what Communist China is going to do, what the Soviet Union is going to do, what the United States is going to do. India is just a non-factor. It just doesn't exist. Now, another thing will start with me, and that is, again, Malaysia, in Indonesia, and in the Philippines. The ethnic majorities have a distrust of the loyalty of the communist minority, of the Chinese minorities, that is so severe as to be almost virulent racism. It's that bad. Now, you can understand this because the Chinese minority was the center of a difficulty during the Malaysian problem. And it was the center of some of the difficulty during the Indonesian problems.
Sure.
Nevertheless, it is much more virulent than I thought. I would come away with this impression. I think that if Communist China does what they think it's going to do, which is to make a major effort at subversion once we're off the continent, I would say that there's a reasonable possibility of progress vis-a-vis the Chinese minority. Some of it's mixed with the fact that they have the money and none of the businesses and that sort of thing. They take the position that the Chinese are essential. Many of them have links to the mainland, read Communist China, which gets things very cloudy. As an outsider, you come away with the impression that that's not really true. It's true maybe only in 10% of the cases. But they think that it's true, and these are people, editors, publishers, television people, not just idiots. Now, finally, and rather unpleasantly, the Nixon doctrine is perceived by them to be diplomatic camouflage for United States withdrawal. I'll come back to that because that's a big job for USIA. We're simply not doing the job in getting out what the Nixon doctrine means. We're talking about, we'll honor our commitments, we'll honor our treaties, we'll do Pacific power, that sort of thing. It's not getting through to the extent that it should get through. In very quick specifics, in the Philippines.
It's also a job for ambassadors abroad.
Yes. Just one or two little items, country by country. The Philippines. I was with Marshall Green when he called President Marcos, and he gave me a very strong pitch on the necessity for normalization and more rational relations with Communist China. And Marcos didn't like it for 1 minute. Didn't want any part of it, didn't believe in it. It was just a kicking steer all the way. Henry Biro in the Philippines is a damn good ambassador, in my judgment. In the Philippines, I would say that they have a latent fear of Japan and a distrust of China. But there, it isn't so much a fear of China as it is a latent fear of Japan. That's right. Indonesia. When I called on Suharto, the ambassador was with me. And Suharto emphasized at great length his interest in explaining the political institutions that he was creating in Indonesia. He talked about the fact that they had 30-odd parties and that they were now going to have 9 political parties, the upcoming elections and what those would mean. The fact that economic development, in his judgment, was the key to withstanding subversion. So his whole concentration was on the development of political institutions and to a very lesser extent an economic development. Galbraith, Tony Linder, that's the first time I've seen Suharto concentrate so much on explaining how he was trying to develop political institutions. So I passed that along to you for what it's worth. He really seemed to be quite convinced that was necessary. He was flat in saying that he thought that subversion by the Communist Chinese was going to be a very major problem. And the only way that he could combat it was to create political institutions and develop the economy. In Indonesia, there is more sophisticated awareness on the part of the leadership there than I would have thought there was, which is about the very tied relationships of Japanese aid. They are appreciative of Japanese aid, but they're rather aware that what Japan does is lend money to build a factory which supplies tires for Japanese cars. And that it's in effect a creation of a Japanese factory. And it's not an infrastructure loan or an untied loan or that sort of thing, which the United States has. Now, in Singapore, I gave that one a very light pass because I got into Singapore in the middle of the Singapore Herald crisis. And, you know, he had his big problem with the press, and perhaps you read it up. And so I didn't call up Lee Kuan Yew. And the only thing I would say about Singapore is the obvious, that the industrial boom in Singapore is extraordinary.
Still amazing.
Still amazing. It's situated in China.
Yeah, that's because it's Chinese.
By coincidence, I had dinner there with Ambassador Strauss's pay, Ambassador to Ceylon, was in town. I'm sure you've heard from other sources. He's a fine man.
No.
I went from Singapore to Malaysia. Malaysia, they have a very, there's some interesting attitude. As you know, they're surfacing these proposals for the big three in their view being Communist China, the Soviet Union, and the United States, to guarantee the neutrality of Southeast Asia. But now, once again, when you talk about the big three, and you say, you know, who are the big three? The Communist China. So where's Japan? Japan's nowhere in that picture in their mind. And yet, you know, you go out on the street and you see evidences of Japan all over the place, and you go out to at Malacca and you look at the strait, and every 15 minutes an oil tanker comes through, and it's a lifeline of Japan from the Perito. And so Japan's vital interests are involved. Our peripheral interests are involved, but Japan's vital interests. So there's no focus on that. They're following that same thing. They aren't focusing on the emergence of Japan. When you mention their trade talks with the Chinese communists and that sort of thing, their comment really is, what else can we do? What choice do we have? It's that sort of approach. They clearly look on the United States as pulling out. They fear extensive subversion coming down to them through the Thailand border after Thais are subverted. And they feel that they have to make an arrangement with the Communist Chinese of some sort. Now, I had this script sent to me every day when I was in Kuala Lumpur of the Voice of Malaysian Liberation. That's a transmitter in Communist China that broadcasts each day in the Malaysian language. And it sits you right up in your chair because it is a very tough program calling for the assassination of the Malaysian leaders, calling for clear revolution and violence. Communist China is certainly following a two-track system because the Voice of the Malaysian Liberation is a rough and hard and preaching violence and overt revolution as you could possibly imagine. In my judgment, in Kuala Lumpur, you have a damn good team, and Jack Lydman is the ambassador, and it just happens that we have one of our best public affairs officers there, who's incredibly known as a girl. And the two of them are, you're very well served in that area. Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, I went to the Nixon Library, which you will be pleased about. It's a very attractive place. I went in there, and there must have been 150 young children quietly reading. You know, if you went to a library where there were American kids, there's always that little hubbub of noise and someone was shooting spitballs. Those Chinese kids are amazing. They sat there and you couldn't hear a sound and they're just reading and looking. It's attractive, it's well decorated, it's light, it's airy, and it's very well used. It's a small thing, but it's attractive. There's a story in Hong Kong which USIA missed, to my chagrin, and I think I know the Western Press has missed it. It's less excusable than for us. There has been, since January, the largest flood of refugees trying to get into Hong Kong from mainland China than they have had in a great many years. Now, there are many... There are rationales to the reason that people say that they're sending the students out to the field and that sort of thing. In any event, I just leave you with it as a statement of fact. The flood of refugees trying to get out of the mainland and into Hong Kong has been larger in the last 6 months than for a very long time. Now, I had dinner with the U.S. press people in Hong Kong. Practically all of the bureau chiefs were there, all the major media in the United States, in addition to people like Reuters and BBC and that sort of thing. Granted that Hong Kong China Watching Post, and granted that China is very chic in terms of news development these days. Nevertheless, once again, the focus on Japan is non-existent. They talk about the future of Asia being where China's going, what the Soviet Union's going to do, and what the United States is going to do. They simply don't focus on Japan as being a big power. Now I come back to David Austin. Remember I mentioned him as a senior and a particular interest in Safari. David Osborne was a former deputy chief of mission in Japan. He is a very decent, straightforward fellow, and you get the feeling that he's very able. He's fluent in Japanese and fluent in Mandarin Chinese, and a long experienced State Department officer. However, he has a very, very strong philosophical views on China, on mainland China. In essence, he believes that the Chinese communists are not basically aggressive, and that China is not basically aggressive. That the solution to the Taiwan problem is to Hong Kongize, as he calls it, Taiwan. Let it become a trading center. To let the military treaty with Taiwan fade away. He believes that Japan will never rearm, that there's a true breakthrough in the human spirit. All of this, these comments, are hopeful. But I rather felt like I was talking with Ken Galbraith in the days when he thought that this is about Nehru and the Chinese communists. My concern is that David Osborne is so intellectual and so able and so convinced of the passivity of the Chinese communists and the fact that Japan will be content indefinitely not to be a factor, that I am quite sure it will fundamentally affect, since your basic Hong Kong, since the China watching structure in state and in your foreign service is Hong Kong, I think that view is going to become pervasive in the think papers, because most of those think papers originate in Hong Kong. And even more importantly, he is well respected and constantly sees the United States bureau chiefs who are resident in Hong Kong. So, I think that some of the think papers that emerge as a result of these very committed views will have to be looked at with some skepticism. Osborne is not a son of a bitch. He's a very decent fellow. But this is what he thinks, and he really sells it at every opportunity. That concerns me because we weren't getting reports on the flood of refugees from China, and we should be getting that from Hong Kong. Well, that doesn't mean a great deal. You see, that would upset the apple cart now, that sort of thing. So I mention that because I think it's significant. Now, in Taiwan, obviously, they're in very deep worry. They're not in a state of panic, but they get bothered every day. Now, the only point of interest to you, I went from Taipei down to Tainan, which is a city, as you know, in the southern part of the island. It's almost exclusively Taiwanese. The only presence we have in those southern cities are some little cultural centers, and we have some of our brightest young officers in there who are fluent in Taiwanese, and they speak to the Taiwanese. I went down and I met with them. Now, they think they're young officers, and they may have localitis, so I give you that as a caveat. Nevertheless, they're fluent in Taiwanese. They constantly speak with the Taiwanese at all sorts of cultural and publications levels. And they believe that the discontent of the Taiwanese politically is much greater than the embassy believes it is in Taipei. They feel that when communist China goes into the United Nations, it will do two things. It will invalidate the return to the mainland dream, and it will invalidate, therefore, the basic premise of the KMT rule, which is that they rule the country from Taipei and the provinces rule from Taichung. And if they're not the ruler of the country, then why are they ruling Taiwan? He believes that once that premise is invalidated, it will inevitably hasten the onset of trouble. Those young officers who speak to the Taiwanese. And it's a little different view than you get from the embassy in Taiwan. In Korea, the thing that impresses you right off is that army. That's an aggressive, well-trained, fine army. Our generals over there look at that army almost with nostalgia. And they have very great confidence in it, provided it's properly equipped. Now, Bill Porter, in my judgment, expresses, Bill Porter is the best ambassador that you have in the Pacific. I won't go through all of the reasons I was going to, but I won't here. Yes, sir, I do. I think philosophically he's sound and he's strong and he's able. I think that the two best ambassadors you have in the field. Byron's very good. Graham Martin in Rome, in that part of the world, and and build water in Korea, in the Asian part. They're both very interesting. Fire-up's very good. They're anticipating the vice president's visit over there. I'll just skip through some of them. Now, on the answer, I just to mention to you remember that you appointed James Michener to the advisory commission, U.S. advisory commission.
Yeah.
I asked James Michener, who has a Japanese wife who speaks Japanese, and he's got entree in circles
sure.
that a lot of people don't. I asked him if he would act as a public member in the inspection team I sent over to inspect our operations in Japan for 18 days, May 10th and the 28th. I sent an inspection team over every couple of years. Michener canceled all his engagements and spent 18 days in Japan just immersing himself. And since he's got a security clearance now, he got everything from our side and everything from the Japanese side. He then had to go to Europe, and I'm going to see him this week. And what I know only secondhand. But he is very concerned with what he perceives to be a potentially deteriorating relationship in the attitude of Japanese influentials about the United States. Now, he may have a lot of other conclusions. I mention this to you because if Japan is as key as we consider it, you wonder...
Here are our businessmen.
What are our influential think about them?
Now, you might wish to see Michener and get these views from him. I leave that up to you as to whether you have an interest in doing that or not. He is a member of your advisory commission, and I don't push it. I simply say that he has submerged himself in this for 18 days. And I know he has come away with some views. Now, he's strong enough in his views to have indicated that he is going to try to mobilize some support in academia to help U.S.-Japanese relations on the cultural side and that sort of thing. I'll leave all of these other things and just go quickly to the motion, which will just take only several moments. I'm ready for you over your liberty and exhibits. Now, I have to give this to you fast because I know you've got people waiting. In my judgment, the most effective weapon that we have for communicating with the people of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union are in this one. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty number one, VOA number two, and the exhibits number three. Right, let's put VOA aside. We're talking about Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and the exhibits. Now, because of what I consider to have been handling, which has been largely inept, which in my judgment is not responsive to what I believe you wanted to do in maintaining these, both of these situations, the exhibits, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, are in very deep trouble, and both of them could go down the drain. Exhibits, probably, and RFERL, possibly. But what we're in now, Mr. President, is a situation where we're in deep trouble in both. At another time, if there's a possibility, I would want to develop with you why I think we're in deep trouble in both. Because what you're seeing now is the inevitable culmination of the method of handling, which has gone on for 18 months and put you in the box in both. Now that's pretty strong. We took the position in both cases, in the exhibits and RFERL, when major efforts were made to dismantle these organizations, that we should be very, very careful in stating our position, that perhaps these things could be compromised. Because, well, I'll read you just a quick thing. There's only one cable I brought you out of many that I fixed. This will make you angry, but you ought to know it anyway. Your consul general in Munich is a man named Darius. Munich is the home of Radio for Europe and Radio Liberty. The single greatest responsibility that the American consul general in Munich has is to be continually knowledgeable about Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty, their usefulness, their liabilities, and the president's policy toward those institutions. Mr. Darius talked with the Lord Mayor of Munich, Mr. Vogel, a while ago on Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, just prior to the Lord Mayor going to Moscow. Here's the cable that he sent, and here's the quote. Vogel asked my personal opinion about the future of the two private centers. Now remember, Mr. Vogel is the Lord Mayor of Munich who's going to annex the Soviet Union. I replied that I thought that was a question that might arise only much later, if Moscow demonstrated by a satisfactory Berlin settlement and other actions that a real relaxation of tensions in Central Europe is possible to achieve. Emphasizing that I had no instructions, I said that if and when that time comes, I thought that the dissolution of the two stations, or at least a modification of their programming, might then become a subject for negotiations between Bonn and Washington. Vogel indicated that this was his view also. Now, if I understand your view, the dissolution of those two stations, or a substantive modification of them, is not something that you have in mind. These two things, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and exhibits, are things that I know about. I don't know about things like the SALT talks and the Berlin negotiations, except indirectly, but I know about these directly. And I know their value to this nation. And I know they have not been supported. And they have not been fought for in the way that they should be. Because people don't believe in these type of instruments. And they think that many of them are anachronistic to the modern age. I find that point of view, one, not what I think your point of view is, and two, has led inevitably to a situation where we may now lose both of these instruments, which I think will create serious domestic political problems. And beyond that, I think it belongs to the country.
Locks.